We're not hearing from any major public officials of prioritizing inmates in the prison systems across the country. And could you talk about your sense of how the vaccinations should be handled and also what the response of inmates would be to the vaccinations?
Yeah, California has a very aging prison population. And so you see elderly people throughout our state prisons who are living in these highly dense congregate settings. We think the vaccine should be available to them as soon as possible. At the same time, the conditions, the public health conditions that make prison living so dangerous existed way before coronavirus came onto the scene this year. Studies show that being in prison itself will age you 10 to 15 years older than people who are not incarcerated. So we don't see the vaccines as a substitute for releases by any stretch of the imagination, but it should be available as soon as possible to keep people safe.
James King, if you can talk about the movement to get the voices of those out inside the prison out, and the idea that on this issue of vaccines, as the U.S. says they're going to institutionalize settings, the most vulnerable, for example, people in nursing homes, prisons have almost become these institutionalized places for many older people close together. How do people protect themselves inside?
I mean, famously at San Quentin and throughout at San Quentin during the height of the outbreak, where thousands of people were infected, at one point prison administrators told the people to sleep head to toe, and that way they would be 6 feet distant from each other. We had reports of people who were sleeping with their masks on, sleeping double masked, when they were fortunate enough to get a mask. The living conditions inside of our state prisons have not been adequate to protect people from this virus at all. And anything that would happen for people in congregate settings of nursing homes, in other facilities, should also happen for people who are incarcerated. Just as the virus is coming into the prisons at an accelerated rate, we know that it's going to grow and come out at an even faster rate.
James King, we want to thank you so much for being with us, member of the Stop San Quentin Outbreak Coalition, state campaigner for the Oakland-based Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. He himself incarcerated at San Quentin from 2013 until this past year. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tiersena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Callas. Thank you for...
Hey, KBOO listeners. Today's another big give day on Give Guide. Today only, when you donate $10 or more to KBOO on Give Guide, you'll get a chance to win a Trek bicycle, courtesy of the Bike Gallery. For your chance to win and to support KBOO today, go to kboo.fm/give.
This is KBOO Portland, radio worth supporting. It's 8:02 a.m. It's Tuesday. It's time for Too Much Information with your hosts, Abe Proctor and Tracy Simmons. Stand by. Stay tuned.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. You're listening to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. My name is Abe Proctor, and I'm joined, as always, this morning by my illustrious co-host, Tracy Simmons. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning, Abe. Good morning, listeners.
We've got a lot to get to today. I want to give you right up front the phone number, 231-8187. That's the number to call to take part in today's conversation. I really hope you choose to exercise that particular option, I suppose I should say at this point that my mom told me that we don't announce the phone number often enough, Tracy. So we don't want to disappoint my mom, particularly at this time of year. Of course not. Okay, Mom? Okay, we got you. 503-231-8187. I'm feeling some kind of way today, Tracy. I got a lot on my mind this morning.
There's a lot going on. So what's going on? What's happening for you?
Well, it's first of all, it's a nice change. It's a welcome thing now to greet every morning with a feeling as if, with a feeling of hope, as if we might be clear of this pandemic in the foreseeable future. The first doses of the Pfizer vaccine were administered in the United States over the weekend. There's going to be widespread distribution starting soon. The first doses, the first few thousand have arrived in the state of Oregon, going to be administered to members of vulnerable populations and to frontline healthcare workers. So the end is in sight, right? I mean, here we are. We're close. We can see the light at the end of the tunnel. But at the same time, we're living through a September 11th's worth of casualties every day. We're losing 3,000 Americans every day. We just passed the 300,000 dead mark. And this is, like I said, it's sort of this it's this strange brew of emotions I'm feeling these days. The hope mixed with the despair, mixed with the frustration, and frankly, the disbelief at this circus, this political circus that parades past us in slow motion, even as Americans are dying by the thousands every day. And even as a lawful elected this bum out on his butt and is elected another president, and instead still we see the resistance. Every single day, we watch the specter. We are forced to endure this as thinking members of a free republic, watching one state sue another about how it conducts its elections. I'm talking about Texas, of course, suing a number of the swing states whose electors voted for Joe Biden and not for Donald Trump. Now, just to draw a sort of analogy to your everyday life, this is like me suing you if you live next door to me because I don't like the main dish you happen to serve for Thanksgiving. It's none of my business, no, but in the integrity of Thanksgiving, in the name of upholding the great Thanksgiving traditions, I'm following suit against you, Tracy, for your Thanksgiving dinner just because I'm Texas and I say that I can. So as we watch this whole parade go by, suddenly 126 members of the Republican House Caucus decide they're going to file amicus briefs in favor of the Texas lawsuit. If you're counting, if you're keeping score at home, that's about 60% of the Republican congressional delegation. So, essentially, here's Texas leading a parade to overturn an election and install Donald Trump as dictator, and more than half of the House Republican Caucus said, yeah, sure, give me some of that. I want a Trump dictatorship. This is a death cult. These people don't care about democracy. They don't care about lifting a finger to help you and your neighbors who are dying by the thousands because of a vicious viral pandemic. They don't care. All they want to do is install a dictator, which leads me to believe that all this time when they've been mouthing these platitudes about freedom and how much they care about America, they don't care. They were just waiting for an opportunity. They were just waiting for the permission structure for them to say no. Finally, we got our guy in position. We are ready. Now is the time. Goodbye, democracy. Hello, dictatorship. And, you know, we don't really care because we're Texas and because we're the Republican Party. This is something that never should have been inflicted upon this republic. It is pathetic. It is un-American. And I hope that every one of those 126 congresspeople are called on the carpet and held to account for this, because this is nonsense. And you know what really gets me, Tracy, is nothing is going to happen to them. They're going to face no consequences for what they're doing. And you know what? They knew it. And that's why they chose to take the stand they did. Because when it comes right down to it, they're cowards. But given the opportunity to slide in the back door and establish a dictatorship, they will take it because they know nothing is going to happen to them. Their districts are so secure. Their boundaries are so gerrymandered. Their voters so polarized that they can count on re-election many, many, many more times in the future. And if each one of them is going to go on Meet the Press, and they're going to sit in front of Chuck Todd, and they're going to intone very seriously about how the deficit is once again the most important thing in the world, and how they have to oppose tooth and nail everything that the new president is doing to try to help the American people. And then Chuck Todd is going to furrow his brow, and he's going to nod his head very seriously, and he's going to thank them in very somber tones for their time, and hope that they can come back on his show again. Meanwhile, they have laid democracy to rest upon an altar of bones, and they will never pay a price. And that's what's been on my mind, Tracy.
Well, tell me how you really feel. I mean, I can tell you're pretty apoplectic over this whole thing. And it is an outrage. It really is an outrage. It's one, if we were in a different time, potentially, right? I mean, it's terrible regardless. But the fact that you're doing all of this and spending so much energy on this, as 300,000 Americans have died on your watch, is unconscionable, right? I understand that this is really what the party is moving towards, right? Contesting every election, really doing everything, fighting tooth and nail to maintain that minority rule that they seek. And of course, the only way to do that is through authoritarianism, right? And so for me, I ask the question, why? You knew this brief was going to get tossed out, which it did, thank goodness. It's, you know, no serious person even read the thing. I couldn't take my time to read the thing. I've got way better things to do. I read, you know, the beginning of it and was like, give me a break. It's not even on the face of it, you know, a valid claim. They use the word irregularities. And I have to ask also, what irregularities? What are you talking about? That people didn't like Trump and voted in certain places 90% for Joe Biden, that's not an irregularity. That's normal. That should have been everybody. But, you know, we know that, you know, if you claim something without any evidence, that there's no legal case or bearing to move it forward. So we have to ask why. But as I started looking into the situation, what I started to notice is always follow the money. So Bloomberg reported in the last few days that Trump has reaped over $207.5 million after his loss because, you know, his donors are really being baited into this whole idea that he's going to be able to stick around, and they're funding these, you know, frivolous lawsuits. And, of course, about 25% of that is getting kicked back to the RNC. So these folks are really riding these coattails from a financial perspective. And to your point, right, they know that they're going to have an upcoming election. They know that they're going to need funding to do that. And so why not ride the coattails of Donald Trump? He said in public that, you know, the people of goodwill would follow him, you know, and really literally follow him into, you know, the flames. But would follow him and sign on to this. And they heard their call that they needed to step up. And at this point, it's so un-American that we're really leading down a slippery slope. Because if this is what happens in 2024, if this is what we can look forward to in every election that the Republicans don't win, especially we know that they never win the popular vote, but if they don't win the Electoral College, that states sue each other for their process and outcome, that we, even the idea of having states' rights, which, you know, the Republicans always talk about states' rights, but they don't even seem to believe that now because it's not working in their favor. And so, you know, we as thinking people really need to do our best to silence these people as much as possible and help the people who continue to vote them in see that these people care nothing about you. They care nothing about your health. They're doing nothing to try and stop this pandemic, which is, you know, evidence of not giving, you know, anything to care about you. And vote them out. You know, when you think about sedition as a you know, incitement to overthrow a government, incitement to overthrow the Constitution, and that's what it is, just from the definition standpoint, no one ever gets, you know, punished for sedition in America anymore. And I truly think that there need to be people who are patriots who stand up and say, no, we're not gonna seat these people in the next Congress. They have really gone against America at the core. They are not patriots. They are not even people who believe that democracy is a value which they should be kind of centering themselves upon as congressmen, you know, in our government. And so there needs to be consequences, but to your point, I feel like there's consequences for people who steal from Safeway. There's consequences for people who drive under the influence. there's something about this kind of, you know, impunity for which the people who control our country are never held to account for pretty much anything. You see Kelly Loeffler and Perdue, you know, going out for, you know, their elections. And we know that they, you know, took money, insider trading, made millions off the pandemic once again, right? And so there's just this air of, like, people who are in power can do pretty much anything and never be held to account for it. And that needs to change.
I think that is sadly true. You're absolutely right. I mean, there's definitely consequences, or at least there have been historically, for somebody who gets caught with a dime bag, you know, but not for somebody who bilks the whole economy and sends it into a recession. You're absolutely right. If you're at the top, if you hold wealth, if you hold money, if you hold power, then you can act with impunity. And let's not forget also that even as you mentioned, these people who are not patriots, who are encouraging their voters and their supporters to perpetuate their time in office, the people who are supporting them, the people who gave the $230 million in counting to Trump's Mussolini fund, can these people even be reached? Are there, every one of those $230 million was an additional vote in favor of dictatorship. I don't know. I don't know, Tracy. I don't know if there's anything we can do to get through to these voters who've tossed their hat in with this man. I don't know if there's anything we can do about this party which has now reorganized itself in this man's image. Where are the principled conservatives I keep hearing about? Where are you? Where is your party has been hijacked by these people. They've been trying to overturn an election, and most of you are going along with it.
Here in Oregon, we had at least 11 people, state senators and state representatives, send a letter to Ellen Rosenblum, who is our state attorney general, and required her to sign on to this terrible amicus brief. And I will name names: Chuck Thompson, Dennis Linthicum, Bill Post, Vicki Breese Iverson, Greg Barreto, David Brocksmith, Alan Olson, Kim Thatcher, Gary Lace, Mike Nierman, E. Werner Reschke, and Representative-elect Bobby Levy. I'm naming names because I feel like these people cannot be trusted with our democracy. They have fundamentally given up on democracy as a philosophy, as, you know, kind of the cornerstone of our country. And, of course, Ellen Rosenblum was like, no thanks, I'll pass. Thank goodness that, you know, we have thinking members of the legislature who would say no to that. But, you know, it's not just other people from other places, right? It's happening here in Oregon, and we should all be very, very worried about that, and we should use our voices in a next election to make sure that these people don't get reseated, because they're going to be the same people calling for this, you know, if whatever happens in 2024. This idea that minority rule should be entrenched and should be really a feature of how power is structured in America is very, very damaging and very scary, right? When we think about a slide into fascism and bringing forth, the next authoritarian who will likely be much more competent than Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani, and you know, his cast of characters.
You know, what's really frightening, too, is when that next authoritarian comes along, sedition will no longer be something that's out of bounds. It's just another play in the playbook now, thanks to all these people. We have now taken one gigantic step closer to losing our republic because of the actions of these people. That's not hyperbole. That is the truth. I mean, it boggles the mind, really. And we haven't even talked about Mitch McConnell. Right? 3,000 Americans are dying every single day. We just passed 300,000 dead from COVID-19. And what's Mitch McConnell's priority? Making sure corporations are immune from liability for any COVID-related deaths or injuries on the job.
Right.
That's his priority.
Any relief to actual people. You're trying to protect corporations from killing people? I mean, you've shown. And you know, people say that quote, you know, people show you who they are, believe them. I don't know what more Mitch McConnell would need to show anybody, but he has never, shown any, demonstrated any care for the people of Kentucky, nor the people of America, as he has sat with all of these, you know,
legislatively agreed upon and pushed forward ideas sitting in a stack on his desk, which he calls the graveyard. You know, at this point, I just feel like there's got to be some kind of revolutionary shift in the electorate, right, the voters, to say no more of this. We have seen so many people die on our walks. It is unconscionable to continue electing these people into power while they have really demonstrated no care for us. It just doesn't even make sense. And all the while, you know, Joe Biden is, you know, still talking about bipartisanship and all that. And, you know, I'm kind of losing a little energy and enthusiasm for that conversation. I absolutely believe that, you know, there needs to be some kind of healing. But I don't know how you heal people who have really turned away from democracy. I don't know how you work with people who don't believe that, you know, a state has the right to determine how its elections will go, and will just say, hey, that's how it went there, and that's the outcome, right? You know, I think in the long term, you're right. We're setting this really nasty precedent that can't be put back in Pandora's box, right? This is not going to. It's going to be part of the playbook. And we're going to see it play out for at least the next 10 years until people are held to account for their behavior.
There is a possible alternative scenario. And actually, before I get to that sort of scenario, I should backtrack just a little bit. It was fascinating to watch the conservative commentary and conservative Twitter as this Texas lawsuit was sort of wending its way toward the Supreme Court and garnering more support across the country. They were excited. They're like, this is it, right? This is finally the thing that's going to overturn the election, right? And we're going to finally lay it at the feet of the Supreme Court, which our guy has stacked now over the course of his single term in office. And it was fascinating to watch the Supreme Court also, because they issued a very short, very terse, unsigned brief, a statement utterly rejecting this lawsuit as could be completely without merit. And they didn't even, you know, open the door wide enough to give it a crack. They said no. And then, of course, predictably, the conservative world lost its head. And before the ink was even dry on that statement from the Supreme Court, the Republican Party of Texas issued a statement in favor of secession from the union. Now, I'd like to reach out to the Republican Party of Texas and encourage them to take that idea and run with it. Perhaps turn your gaze eastward to your neighbors. Perhaps invite Louisiana and Arkansas and Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and Florida and the Carolinas and Tennessee and Kentucky. You all could just be on your way. Maybe that's the way forward, he said, tongue firmly in cheek.
You know, I of course do not want to see anyone secede, or for there to be, you know, the country of New Cascadia, of course, the West Coast out here. But, you know, I mean, I don't know. Once again, I don't know how we feel. And so I've seen some of these, you know, kind of proposed ideas to leave, you know, flyover country to itself and keep pushing as a country that really wants progress and really wants to take care of the humans within. And kind of abandon these kind of not globalist, but more corporatist interests that, you know, so many of the Republican Party and you know, in places where the Republicans are in power, we know that there is a deep need. There's deep need in the education sector. There's deep need for meeting people's basic needs. And we know that income is stagnant in those places. And so when do those people wake up and say, hey, what's happening to me is because of the people who are in power here and the fact that they've never done anything to take care of us. I don't know what it takes for those people, but, you know, there are those, you know, kind of commentaries out there of you know, people who could benefit the most from these kinds of supports, right? We call it, quote-unquote, socialism. They don't want nice things because they know if they get nice things, other people might have nice things too. And it's baffling. It boggles the mind that you don't want the things that would help you in your life, whether that's universal basic income, whether that's health care, whether that's, you know, meeting basic needs of food and shelter and other, you know, regular things that people need. Thinking back to, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. But they don't want them because they know somebody else is going to get them. And it just doesn't make any sense to me.
I can't have nice things, then no one can have nice things.
So going back to sedition, right, we have the pro-Trump lawyer Lynn Wood urging Trump supporters to stock up on Second Amendment supplies. We have, you know, there was, of course, a rally.
Second Amendment supplies. I love it.
Right. Quote, unquote, Second Amendment supplies. Also telling, you know, people to go ahead and get out there in Washington, D.C. and have your voices heard. And I think there was something like 26 people were stabbed in D.C. this weekend after those rallies happened. It's attributed to the Proud Boys. And really taking their cue from Donald Trump, as he said, you know, in one of the debates, to, you know, stand back and stand by. I guess, you know, they're ready for action, and stabbed at least 26 people in D.C. There were some skirmishes and movements between multiple groups. But, you know, so we're seeing also violence. And so, you know, when we think about sedition, the incitement to overthrow either the Constitution or those duly elected, we have to say there is a one-to-one correlation. And you know, right now we're kind of in that middle period where, you know, this violence, because it is unabated, and right, we've got Donald Trump throwing gasoline on the fire, and his you know, people within his camp also encouraging and inciting these kinds of behaviors. It's a scary time from that perspective as well.
Yeah. All right, you're listening to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Let's go to the phones. Joe, good morning.
Good morning. You folks are fired up and ready to go this morning. I'm the person who has called before and suggested that we need regional differences throughout the country and to come apart, but that went nowhere. And I agree that doing that is a major problem. However, the middle part of the country has now gained so much traction by poking their fingers in progressive eyes and recognizing that they can get what they want, or at least have an authoritarian who can help them get what they want, so that they are not going to turn back. I moved out to Oregon 30 years ago from Indiana, and I maintain some relationships from back there. And I know how some of those folks, how these folks think. And I refer to Indiana now as the new Alabama of the North, because that region is turning more conservative. So my suggestion is that the West Coast, including Hawaii, that we have four states that work in conjunction with each other and truly start to go with more state rights, that we are going to be more independent and work on our own, because the West Coast and the East Coast is the economic engine of this country. And there's no reason why we need to be tied to a Mitch McConnell who's from one of the most backward states in the country but maintains the most power of most any person in the country. It's time for the progressives to get their act together and say, look, we are not going to play this game and follow down the road of just going to the least common denominator, uneducated, non-scientific. I mean, come on. Kentucky has a Noah's Ark, and people go and support it. This is not who we are on the West Coast. We're ready to move forward with economics, with our coming to terms with our racist past, with having young people have a future that also goes with climate change. So let's turn the page and recognize we have to come apart, or at least have the idea that we can go separate ways with our state rights.
Hey, thank you for the call. That was a fantastic call.
Thank you.
It does provoke the imagination a little bit, doesn't it? Like if you took California, Oregon, Washington, and for sake of argument, we'll throw in Hawaii. You've got a little bit north of 50 million people there, I think. I think that's more than enough people to form a tax base to create a viable single-payer healthcare system, for example. It's also a pretty large region geographically. You could institute, working in concert, some pretty broad-ranging environmental policies as well. I think the caller's kind of getting at, you know, why not just go ahead regionally and make the sort of cultural and economic changes we want to make? You know, if that leads to eventual, you know, friction with or dissolution from the rest of the union, so be it. Hopefully, the rest of the country would know a good example when they saw one and start doing the same thing.
I mean, we can build those regional pacts without anybody's, you know, signing off on it. I think the challenge is that the current situation is that we pay those other countries currently, and that is problematic because we continue to shift resources to these states who are, you know, number 45 in fiscal health as far as Kentucky is concerned. And, you know, there is a propping up of red states that we do as blue states. And so we would need to get rid of that so we could pool our own resources for the benefit of the people that we are trying to solve challenges with.
Wait a minute now. When Mitt Romney said half of the country was on the take, I'm pretty sure he wasn't talking about the red state, Tracy.
No, absolutely not.
All right, let's go to Cassandra. Good morning.
Good morning. I do understand the anger, the frustration, and the anxiety of the previous caller. Lord knows there are days when that's all I feel, that a separation should be the thing. But I hate to say this. I didn't get online today to argue this point. We're splintered enough. If we're going to solve environmental global problems, we have to start splintering even further. We cannot put everything into effect only on the West and East Coast and think that somehow globally we won't be affected by what they do in the Midwest, that their antiquated medievalism is not going to come back and get us as well. If we simply set up our own invisible wall between us, I don't think that's the solution. What I think, and this is what I actually got on to talk about, is one of the things that we have done in this country, or not done, is we have not put regulations, as it were, on our Constitution. In other words, we regulate, or want to, those of us that know that it serves a good purpose. We want to regulate our air quality, our water quality, our food standards, our medical standards, and so forth and so on. But what we have done in this country since day one of the Constitution's being put into place, and I say Constitution's because, you know, the Federalist Papers was, for all intents and purposes, Constitution 1. Now we're on 2. And what we have done is allow gentlemen's agreements, and that was all it was ever meant to be, was between the elite gentlemen to rule this country. We have not regulated this. We have allowed Mitch McConnell to take a position that does not exist in the Constitution. Article 1, Section 3, Paragraph 4 very clearly states, the Vice President of the United States shall be President of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided. Harris is now the head of the Senate. But unless she walks in there and takes that position, which is hers legally, and has been every vice president's legally, Mitch McConnell's is not within the Constitution. If we say we are for the Constitution, then we have to start abiding by it, and we need to stop going on tradition and start laying down laws. We make this a holier-than-thou document. It was created, for God's sakes, you know, hundreds of years ago. Are we really still following this concept that we have to go by what the founders intended? They intended for white Protestant men, no women, no black people, no one of any color, to rule this country, of only property men, not even white men without property. Do we really want to go back to that? There is not one member of the founders that you could look at and say that with a clear conscience, that was the one we should be following. Every single one of them had flaws. They were human beings. And we need to start looking at what we need now, use what works in the Constitution, and start working with it to fine-hone it and put it into laws, not just a gentleman's agreement that people like Mitch McConnell have proven. They're no gentlemen. They're going to break their agreements every damn time it suits them. And the Democrats stand by spinelessly allowing them to do it. That's my rant for the morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the call. Tracy, you have any thoughts here?
Oh, yes. I mean, I totally understand that there is no position of majority or minority leader in the Constitution. And, you know, we could easily say, no, that's not how this was set up. But it would take someone, of course, as Cassandra said, stepping in and saying, no, that's not how that was conceived. This is all made up. We've made this up to continue to, you know, really rein in minority power, because the whole makeup of the Senate is about minority power, right? When we have Wyoming that has, you know, not enough people to really, you know, make a state, have the same kind of representation as other states, you know, California, for example, even Oregon, right? It's not balanced, and so the whole makeup is kind of shady. But yeah, that position does not exist, and the power which that person has imbued upon themselves, Mitch McConnell we're speaking about, doesn't allow for a representative democracy. It's a huge barrier. And so, you know, as I'm, you know, consistently thinking about progress and what it takes to move progress forward, and, you know, specifically thinking about principles of critical race theory, which some people think is, you know, complete hoax, whatever. I'm not ready or willing to debate that. But, you know, as we think about the status quo, part of analyzing the status quo is also analyzing what about the status quo gets in the way of progress? And we know that that is a huge piece of it. So let's get rid of that. That's not in the Constitution. We could say that's unconstitutional. We could take it to the Supreme Court and say that every decision that Mitch McConnell has made to not bring things to the Senate floor to be voted on is unconstitutional because it's not in the Constitution. And if we have the true originalists sitting on the Supreme Court, how would they say that that's not true? We just have never done it. We have never moved into that space to be really assertive as progressives to really analyze what's happening, what's working, and what's not working. And we know this is one thing that is the biggest barrier to creating true legislative, you know, movement for people, right? We know that Mitch McConnell stays in place because his corporate interests and the way that he makes money is by appeasing those corporate interests. But if we could just get him out of the way, regardless of what happens in Georgia, I mean, I'm all for it.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I mean, Cassandra mentioned that we have no regulations on the Constitution. I kind of wish she had elaborated on that a little bit. What I think maybe she was trying to get at is the fact that it's, you know, it's incredibly difficult to change it. Amending the Constitution is an enormously, you have to clear a hugely high bar, and it's a very time-consuming process, and unlikely to be put into effect with regard to any of the most pressing issues that we have confronting us right now. So absent the ability to, you know, to wholesale remake big sections of the Constitution, we have to work, you know, within the boundaries and the parameters that are already established for governance, which is why I think it's so important that these 126 congressional Republicans who added their names in support of a lawsuit that would have allowed a losing president to keep his seat, none of those people should be allowed within spitting distance of any elected office ever, because clearly they don't understand what it means. Clearly they are not there to carry out the duties of their office. Clearly they have no understanding of or respect for the concept of democracy. If we were just, if we were interested in having a truly representative and functional constitutional republic, the Speaker of the House would refuse to sit each and every one of those people for the upcoming session of Congress. Which means, yes, we would have to limp through a session down 126 Republicans. But I say that's an obstacle we can deal with.
I say that the damage has been done, and the damage will continue to be done if people are not held to account for their behavior.
Agreed. And I think this goes beyond the holders of elected office. One of my big criticisms of the Obama administration was his pledge almost immediately upon taking office to look forward, that it was just going to slow us down and drag us down if we looked back at what had happened before. And thus, all of the multi-billionaires who nearly tanked our global economy didn't face any accountability. None of them went to jail and essentially were allowed to continue doing what they had done. The need for accountability transcends elected office. It extends into the highest levels of the plutocracy, which now actually controls the mechanisms of our government. So not only do we need a rededication of civic duty and public purpose in our elected officials and our appointed officials, we need to bring accountability to the very richest among us who have so distorted how our republic operates. Unfortunately, both of those things are very unlikely to actually come about.
Yeah, I think we need to push forward, and I think part of what our duty is as citizens is to hold our elected officials accountable and say, no, we're not looking back. We don't want this to happen again. And if we don't look back and see what actually happened and take stock of all of the shenanigans that have happened in the Trump administration, we are setting up fertile ground for the next dictator. We really are. And so, you know, I think there needs to be some pressure applied in all ways to say, no, this is what we brought you here. We got you this far to this election. Now you're in the role. And no, all of the bipartisan talk, all of that is great. But without holding people accountable, we're stabbing ourselves right in the foot. And I say stabbing because I don't like shooting, but we're doing ourselves a disservice as a country who want to maintain and perpetuate democracy as our most fundamental value.
Yeah, and I think it's probably safe bet that the next would-be dictator is not going to be held back by crippling narcissism and a subpar intellect. The next would-be dictator may be much more competent than Trump. And given the precedent that's now been set, that's something that ought to send a chill down every American spine. Let's go to Constant Walker. Good morning.
Hello, how are you?
Well, did I get your name right?
Yeah, you did.
Okay.
Just about everything you've been saying about Republicans and Trump and all that is a perfect description of the behavior of America in its entire history. And now it's all coming home to roost, and you don't like it. This entire
Is
occupied with genocidal violence. And now it's coming home to roost, and you don't like it.
That's true.
It is true. And until you guys reckon with that as citizens and hold yourselves to account for all of the benefits you've enjoyed on the blood and bones of the people who lived here before your ancestors came, you're going to keep experiencing worse and worse things happening to you. It isn't your politics. It's your fundamental values, which are America goes around the world with impunity, installs dictators, slaughters millions, and you don't think it's going to ever come back here? Well, it's here now.
So those are not my fundamental values.
No, mine either.
So you've given everything that you have back to the native people here, right?
I am a native.
I'm not sure what you mean by that. I mean, do you mean that has Tracy and I personally grappled with the legacy of the genocidal westward expansion of this nation? I can't speak for Tracy, but I've spent a great deal of time grappling with that and considering how that egregious wrong might be righted. But I don't think that's the same as saying that that I harmonize with American imperialism personally as a value. No, that's not the case.
Well, everything you guys say that you talk about our country. Well, this isn't your country. This is Indian country. You don't acknowledge the reality that you're living in. You're living in a kind of pipe dream. America is this and America is that. America is not a democracy for one thing. It never has been. And it goes around the world setting up and perpetuating dictatorships all over the world. And here it's coming back to roost.
Okay, well, I acknowledge that this broadcast is taking place on stolen land. That I now sit on land that was occupied by the Multnomah, Calumet, and Clackamas bands of the Chinook. And that land was forcibly taken from them. And that is a historical wrong that can never be fully redressed.
Well, it could be, but the will of the American people just doesn't run in that direction, because it will require huge sacrifices and the acknowledgement of huge wrongs done and huge things to make them right. And so far, the American people, in all of their exceptionalism, don't think they have to do that.
Well, I can't argue with that last point. Listen, hey, thank you very much. For the call and for holding us to account.
Yeah, sure.
Let's go to John. Good morning.
Hello, are you still there? Okay.
Yes.
There was I think it was your first caller who was calling about Indiana and et cetera.
Not our first caller, but yeah, go ahead. Thing.
Well, you know, and also you followed up, or both of you people followed up, about, you know, interstate agreements between states, like a co-op. Well, actually, the blueprint has already been wrote, and it was written back, I think, 73 or 75, and the book was called Ecotopia. And what it was...
Yeah, I read it.
Yeah, and wasn't that wild? Mm-hmm. I mean, the first... Yeah. One of the things that still stands out for me is that Ecotopia protected itself from the U.S. government by accessing Livermore laboratories around the Bay Area. And they, they planted nuclear-tipped landmines from Washington State down to Sacramento to make sure that the U.S. government didn't invade them. So I thought that was kind of cool. But anyway, you know, if you remember the book Ecotopia, it was a country inside a country, because they let a lot of groups, whether it be African-American or Native Americans, have their own little... slice of paradise. And so it was a loose confederation within a confederation of states. And so I thought that was, when that guy was bringing it up about Indiana, and then the conversation went into, maybe states should just separate. Well, but, Ecotopia was one of my favorite books, just because it was a regional thing. That's all I have to say.
Hey, thanks for the call. Yeah, it's a fascinating and compelling book. It gets a lot of things right, I think, about what a sustainable, enlightened society would be like. It stumbles a little bit on the race question, I'll be honest. But it's worth a read out there, listeners, if you're interested. Ecotopia by Ernest Kallenbach. And while we're on this subject, this is one that I find particularly compelling, because I confess right now that I have been intrigued by the idea for a long time of the Cascadia Republic. Right, a separate nation comprised of a chunk of Northern California, Oregon, Washington, and possibly British Columbia. I think there's a lot going for that idea, but there's a whole host of reasons why it's problematic at best and not feasible at worst. But if we're talking about an expression of regional values, there's a lot I think that the West Coast states could accomplish working in concert with each other. To establish at least a part of a country, a region of an existing country, that is operating on a more enlightened plane. And that's something that I find exciting for the future. Like I said earlier, it's not inconceivable that you could say a tri-state single-payer healthcare system if the political will were there and if it were able to survive the inevitable court challenges. But that's another story. Let's go to James.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello?
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Sorry, mind, James.
Hang on.
Yes. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
okay, sorry.
Sounds like maybe
Bluetooth
James.
Wasn't working apparently. Okay, so I just want to echo what the caller previous said. You know, I think the biggest thing that we keep overlooking here is that not only has the capitalist system failed, but it's really in general settler colonialism. I mean, there's only so much progress you can make building your building your house on a on stolen land. I mean, it's the elephant in the room. Nobody wants to address it. Doesn't matter like what type of small, independent, little country states you want to set up. You're still doing it, you know, whether or not, you know, you're doing it with, you're doing it against Native American sovereignty, number one. And number two, I mean, you're just, it's just not acknowledging the truth of where this is. I mean, not only has the capitalist system broke down twice, huge, in 75 years, you know, but on top of that, you know, it's always petty reformism that only benefits the settler colonial class. You know, I mean, unless you're talking about, you know, enfranchising small bits of the neocolonial proletariat, you know, like for instance, you know, Black Reconstruction, which was to prevent revolt because they figured, you know, give Black folks a little bit and make them feel special, you know, rather than, you know, losing the entire South and setting up a new African Republic, which was the plan. I mean, there's only so much you can do. And as much as I appreciate your passion, man, it's just, it's so misguided. I mean, I don't know if you've seen that video that The Intercept just released of Joe Biden talking to the most preeminent Black leaders in the country, but he basically talked to them like they were children. You know, it went through an hour and 3 minutes of very specific demands from the president as he comes into office, and he basically said, yeah, I'll get it done. I think you guys are impatient. I think it's ridiculous that you're coming to me when I haven't even had a chance to do anything yet. You know, I mean, and we know Joe Biden's history. I mean, Joe Biden was just better than Trump because he kept his mouth shut. You know, I mean, his
I think it did racial better for more reasons than that.
You know, when he you know, or his what was it, his remarks on racial integration, his drafting of the 1994 crime bill, his helping draft NAFTA, you know, which would explain why the people in the Midwest are upset, to be honest. We could talk about the fact that he drafted the bill that kept students who are currently suffering because of their student loans locked into their student loans. I mean, it just perpetuates a pettiness that is going to solve nothing.
Nevertheless, though, he is the president, and we have to lean on him and push him to do the right thing to the extent possible. Will we get as progressives everything we want, or even a sliver of what we want? Probably not, but we still have to work with what we have, because the alternative is too horrible.
Which is, well, the alternative is only horrible in the sense, if you think about it in terms of cult of personality. I mean, Joe Biden is a neoliberal puppeteer. He's pulled a lot of strings for over 40 years. I mean, Donald Trump is a profiteer. He's profited off of the things that Joe Biden has done. I mean, he's the president, I guess. Really what it comes down to is that this land was taken and a republic was forced upon it without our consent. And so now we're talking about the whole ideas of how to reorganize a country that technically it's really just run its course, you know, but people who believe in capitalism and quote unquote freedom want to keep reinflating the system. That's what made Obama so terrible. He tried to reinflate a deflated capitalist bubble. You know, he was just the black face for Wall Street, you know, and it's like, we've been dealing with this neoliberal, you know, crap for 40 years, and we think that electing a Democrat is going to help. It's just, I mean, I see your passion, but I think it's so misguided, man. I mean, you really got to look at reality. You really got to take in the whole of history. Joe Biden is not a good guy. I mean, he might be better on his face value than Trump, probably, but if you look at his history and what he's done, and especially the lies he's perpetrated, considering his civil rights service, I mean, talk about stolen valor. I mean, I'm just saying, man. I mean, you guys can do you, but I just feel like, you know, we need to stop talking about petty settler bourgeois reformism and really look at revolution. Land back to the Native Americans. Black Lives Matter.
Thanks for the call. You were going to say something, Tracy?
I continue to want to say something and ask, what would folks want us to do? Are we talking about, you know, a new civil war? Is that what people are asking for? Because what's so interesting is when I hear folks, and I am absolutely Black Lives Matter and Land Back kind of person, but I don't believe that widespread violence to take land back is the way that we move forward as a country. I don't want to be part of a civil war. I absolutely don't believe in storing and having guns. And that's not something that I'm interested in doing. What I am interested in doing is really moving away from the incrementalism for people to stand up and say, no, we voted you in office and this is what we want. And for people to get really savvy about how they do that, as well as how they hold their elected officials accountable to the things that we want. And so we've seen, you know, things play out at the Red House here in Portland, where, you know, we've seen a resolution coming and barricades going down. But for the people who say we are misguided in wanting to push upon the elected officials and the current system that we have, I will continue to ask, what is your solution? Because I don't want to talk about what happened 300 years ago without coming up with a solution for what we do about that today. I mean,
I totally agree.
I know history. I'm quite aware. I am a descendant of slaves in the American, you know, countries. I am also a descendant of Native American people in America. And so, yeah, I'm fully invested in what is the solution. I would love to hear from people who are like, you know, this is not the way for me to understand what they would propose as a solution that doesn't lead to a bloody civil war in 2020.
Agreed. Civil war is too horrible to contemplate, nor am I willing to throw out my hands and sit back and toast marshmallows while everything burns. Neither of those are acceptable options for me. Therefore, we must work with what we have. There might be some of you out there who are willing to, who do that mental calculus and say, yes, civil war is a way to go. But I would really urge you to reconsider that stance. And you're not going to hear us on this show advocating that course of action. Let's go to Robbie. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Weren't you just advocating for the southern states to succeed?
Yeah, I was, but I wasn't serious about it.
Okay, all right. Well, here's the dilemma that I think some of the more progressive individuals that call into the show are trying to communicate. I do have solutions. A part of these solutions is recognizing a common history, and that seems to be where we're straying away from. Like, for instance, I'll give a perfect example. Elizabeth Warren said that ICE protects us from drug dealers and terrorists. That's not a progressive individual. That's not a person that any progressive would agree with. Kamala Harris let Steve Mnuchin, whatever his name is, Steve Mnuchin, back when she was the district attorney go. I actually worked for a mortgage company, and I saw firsthand how Obama bailed out the banks instead of the people. The problem that we're facing here is you can't hold elected leaders accountable after you elect them. And so if we are going to hold these leaders accountable, it's going to come to the recognition that Kamala Harris works for the banks or the private prison industry. It's going to be the fact that Elizabeth Warren was a conservative. So like these are kind of more specific nuances that I'm pointing out here, but unless we can agree on that, there is no holding accountable, you know, no holding public officials, you know, accountable if we can't come to the same, you know, ideas that this is where they're wrong. What I've been hearing from the Democrats is, well, we have to vote for Joe Biden. And what's happening now is that the Democrats who aren't paying attention to history, it's like if enough people were paying attention to history, we would have been questioning the Electoral College back in the year 2000 when I first became aware of it. And when I first was like, why are we doing this? It took, you know, 20 years for us to, as a collective conscious of Americans to be like, why are we doing this? So we're not paying attention. And people who think that Elizabeth Warren is a progressive is not paying attention. We're looking at identity politics, and we're going to get screwed over every time if all we're doing is looking at the surface level. So I'm not advocating for civil war. Actually, I've dedicated my life to talking to these Patriot Prayer, Proud Boys. And what I do when I talk to them, Joey Gibson knows me quite well, not on good terms, he has to run away from me because I start asking him questions about the Bible. You know, how can you call yourself this? Because what I'm doing is what I'm, and they'll have to turn their live streams off when I'm doing it, is I'm pointing out their hypocrisies. And it's not everybody on that right side is like that. You get one or two Joey Gibsons that preach to the 10, you know, the hundreds of them. But I've had success with one person that I've been able to talk to. I'm getting a little bit sidetracked, but my point here is that we need to recognize that accountability happens when we can all collectively agree on something and stop being forced to go left or right. Because that initial, oh, well, we got to go left or right, is what got us into this trap. I've been against Obama since he was, you know, since, you know, Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter the first time, and Dakota Pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so now what I'm witnessing is Democrats just being like, oh, well, we got to do Democrat stuff. And the Democrats were never on our side. In fact, the Democratic Party is shunting the progressives as we speak. They tried to get AOC unseated. Like, the, and at what point are we going to, you know, and here's, we've talked about this before. You're like, well, where's the viable third party? There's not going to be one because the system is working exactly as it's intended. The system is fixed.
Fair enough. I think we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. I apologize, Robbie. I want you to call earlier in the show, dude. Sometimes I feel like we need a little more time with you than at the end. But nonetheless, thanks for the call. Tracy, thank you for bearing with me as I ranted to start the show.
I've got an entertainer.
Thanks for keeping me in bounds. And thank you, listeners, for taking part in the conversation. As always, this has been Too Much Information with Abe Proctor and Tracy Simmons on KBOO 90.7 FM. Stay well. There's a vaccine on the way. And we'll be back at you next week.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Did you know that 80% of KBOO's funding comes from individual supporters? Show your support by donating KBOO on GiveGuide today at www.kboo.fm/give. And thanks for supporting volunteer-powered, community-focused radio.